The human being who lived 2,000 years ago, named Jesus Christ of Nazareth, had more impact on the world and on humanity than the sum total of all other human beings combined. Now, much of the impact was due to his powerful moral teachings, and they were coupled with his perfect life. So those two things had a profound impact on all the humans around him. But there was one other thing that added to the impact that he had on humanity, and that was the miracles performed during his 3.5-year ministry. Now, to be more precise, they were miracles that God the Father performed through him, as Christ himself said. But the miracles that he performed were many, and they were spectacular. So this message today is to give a brief overview of the miracles recorded in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that were performed by Jesus Christ during his 3.5-year ministry, and suggest some purposes for those miracles. And I think that you can see that there are many, many purposes, but we'll go into the message and we can go from there. So, but before getting into reviewing the miracles that are recorded in the Gospels, I wanted to mention a few things. First of all, what were those events called miracles that Christ performed during his ministry? So just what were miracles? Well, our booklet, Jesus Christ, The Real Story, has an excellent inset in the chapter in the chapter called A Sinless and Miraculous Life. So this is what's said in that little box, that inset in that chapter. Could Jesus perform miracles? Is the heading of that. One of the major objections to miracles is that they violate natural law. A lot of skeptics will say that. Critics argue that natural law is immutable, therefore natural law cannot be violated. And then it says, if there was no God, then this might be true. But where did the laws of nature, physics, energy, and matter come from? How did they originate? Did these laws of such incredible precision and orderliness create themselves? And then dropping down in this, it says, if God is real, we would expect that miracles, in exactly the way they are recorded for us in the Gospel, would be a very reasonable part of the life of one who wanted to prove his divine identity to those around him. Strictly speaking, Jesus did not perform miracles, like I said, on his own, having given up that divine power. And it quotes Philippians 2, verses 6 through 8. So if we could just quickly go to that and see that verse, those verses that were mentioned. So Philippians chapter 2, verses 6 through 8, it says, it's referring to Christ, and it says, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. I'm using the King James, happen to be using that right now. Christ showed the ultimate awesome example of humility, emptying himself and coming down here as a physical human being. So he divested himself of that power, and he had to depend totally upon God the Father for the power to do these miracles and to live as well as to teach and to do and to live the sinless life that he also did. So, and then just a few other words out of this inset. For God, the omnipotent Creator who designed the laws of nature, it is nothing to supernaturally intervene in the creation to carry out what we might deem impossible. And then concluding, in Christ's case, the Father answered his every prayer and backed up his every command. They were one, totally one. And so God the Father performed these miracles through his Son, Jesus Christ. Now, in the New Testament, two Greek words are used for miracles, and I went to the Vine's Complete Expository Dictionary, and one of the words is dunamis, and the other one is semion. And in that dictionary that I mentioned, Vine's Dictionary, this is what it says of dunamis: power, inherent ability, is used of works of a supernatural origin and character, such as could not be produced by natural agents and means. So that's one. That's one of the Greek words. The other one, sumion, is a sign, mark, or token, is the meaning of that, is used of miracles and wonders as signs of divine authority. And that one is the vast majority of the instances in the New Testament where miracles are described. It's using that latter Greek word. But the other one is used in certain instances too. So then I would like to just, this one more thing before we get into looking at the miracles of Christ, is the author Herbert Lockyer wrote a book called All the Miracles of the Bible. And one of the chapters deals with Christ's miracles. And I'm going to read just a little bit of what he said in his book to begin the chapter that was called The Miracles in the Gospels. And this is what he said: it is impossible to calculate how many miracles Christ performed. Most of them are referred to collectively, and those are greatly in excess of the number recorded in detail. Not all he said or accomplished is recorded, and the many references to and he called the word unparticularized, but it meant not described in detail, miracles indicate that those he relieved or removed from the account must have been considerable. So he didn't inspire all of his miracles to be recorded in the Gospels. And then, so what I would like to do is ask, Mr. Taylor, if you could go to the next slide, please. And this is a list. We're not going to go through each of these in detail, by the way, but because you could see how many there are. This is a list of all the references to mass miracles, unspecific miracles, that Christ performed. And if we could go to just the first one, just to give you an example of what is stated about all of these generalized instances where his miracles are described. Matthew 4, verses 23 through 24 is one, and we'll just read that one. And I think you might be able to read it up there. But he says, and he went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every disease and every affliction among the people. So his fame spread throughout all Syria, and they brought him all the sick, those afflicted with various diseases and pains, those oppressed by demons, epileptics, and paralytics, and he healed them. And the others are just other instances throughout his ministry where it describes these mass, spectacular miracles that Christ performed. I guess if we could go to one that I think is a great, if we can go to the very last end, the end of the book of John, just to summarize, and that's one of those that's included on that slide, but John chapter 21 and verse 25, John said, the very last verse of the book of John, and there are also many other things which Jesus did, the which, if they should be written every one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that should be written. Amen. No wonder, even in Satan's world, it could not be denied, although some try, that there was historically a man named Jesus of Nazareth who lived about 2,000 years ago. It cannot be denied because the impact that his life had on humanity was so great. The only thing Satan could do is try to pervert Christianity and pervert his teachings. But he could not stop the knowledge of the existence of Christ from being carried on down. It had too much of an impact on his followers and those that they touched. So with that, brethren, let's just one more. There's many summaries about Christ's miracle working deeds during his life, but another one, and then we'll get right into it, is in the book of Acts, chapter 10, verses 36 to 38, and this is what the Apostle Peter, how he summarized it, who was, of course, a witness right there with Christ throughout all of this. In Acts 10, verses 36 to 38, the word which God sent to the children of Israel, preaching peace through Jesus Christ, of course, it's referring to God the Father sent, He is Lord of all. That word you know, which was proclaimed throughout all Judea and began from Galilee after the baptism which John preached, how God the Father anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and with power, and who went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. That's just a summary of his miracle-working impact. Now, one more thing, before we actually get into the miracles I wanted to just review with you, brethren, is that even before Christ's 3.5-year ministry, there were miracles performed dealing with Jesus Christ. And one that Mr. Alfred Edersheim referred to as the miracle of miracles. The miracle of miracles was performed when God became a flesh and blood human being, the incarnation. The incarnation of the Son, God, who will become the Son of God the Son, into a human being is an incredible miracle that is awesome to think about. And of course, John very simply described that miracle of miracles in John chapter 1 and verse 14. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Even in His physical state, He was glorious. Even though He didn't have His glorified spirit body, He was still glorious by His very life and character. Now, in addition to the incarnation, the fact of His uniquely miraculous birth from by the Virgin Mary was another miracle that occurred. And another miracle before, and if there are others, I'd love to hear after services discussing it with you. But just fasting 40 days and 40 nights before the ministry started was a miracle. So those were miracles before His ministry officially started. And now I want to read something to you. I want to read this, zeroing in on the miracles I want to read to you. As to the specified miracles on record, it will be found that expositors, different Bible scholars, in their writings differ as to the number. Fawcett says the 40 miracles of Christ recorded are but samples out of a greater number. So he counted 40 specific miracles. Scrogi says they are 35 in number. Now I'm going to go by that simply because in Unger's Bible Dictionary, there's a table called the Miracles of Our Lord, and that uses, I think, that scholar's count of 35. So we'll go on that basis, but I will say that these are 35 major specific miracles, and as I was reviewing this, some of the miracles have embedded in them other miracles. So I can see why the count is actually more than 35. There are some that include other miracles within a miracle. So it's very intriguing. So basically these 35 miracles, I just tried to categorize these miracles. Now, one article that was written in article states that basically there, I'm trying to find the exact thing here to tell you. But basically, one scholar mentioned that there, the two categories of miracles are the healings and the natural, the superseding of natural law, other supersedings of natural law. So anyway, that was how one person categorized it. But just counting the 35 miracles that we're going to go through, there was turning water into wine. There were many kinds of healings from afflictions. There was the resurrections of people back to physical life. There was the omniscience of Christ where he read people's minds. There was the multiplication of food. There was walking on water. There was stilling a storm. There was catching huge quantities of fish. And then there was, to show that God has a sense of humor, there was one where he caught a fish with a coin inside in order to pay the temple tax. And there was the cursing of the fig tree. And there was the miracle of instantly being transported to another physical location. So, in April 1994 article in Bible Review, that's what I was trying to look for. The writer there, Mr. Jarl Fossum, said he categorized these as healing miracles and nature miracles. That's what I was looking for. Some, Fossum said, some allude to the Old Testament events, but I substitute the word always, serve some theological purpose. So every one of the miracles that Christ inspired to be included in the Gospels was there because there was a reason for it. There was a purpose for us to know about that miracle. Because, of course, God never does anything without a purpose. And so, with that in mind, if we could go to the next slide, please, to start going through these. And so I will be looking at the first one here. The first one mentioned is turning water into wine. And if we could go to John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, that's where that's recorded. And there were 8 miracles mentioned in the book of John. And they were the purpose. The book of John is the one that concentrates on theology and emphasizing Christ's divinity. And so these miracles revealed Christ's divine power. 2 were also in other Gospels. 6 were unique to the book of John. And 7 were before Christ's resurrection, and 1 was after. So there was a total of 8 major miracles mentioned in John out of those 35. So if we can go here, I'll just start reading. And the third day, there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And dropping down, I'll continue, actually. And both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. And when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And anyway, well, Jesus said to her, "Woman, what have I to do with you? My hour is not yet come." And but that was not a disrespectful term, as if you study that. But anyway, he waited, and then he said, Jesus saith to them, then finally he said to the servants, and I'll start with actually here in verse 6, "And there were set there 6 water pots of stone after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing 2 or 3 firkins apiece. Jesus saith to them," in other words to the servants, in verse 5 this says, this is referring to the servants, "Fill the water pots with water. And they fill them to the brim. And he saith unto them, Draw out now, and bear to the governor of the feast. And they bear it. And when the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not where it was, but the servants which drew the water knew, the governor of the feast called the bridegroom and said," most people serve the good wine first, and then after you've had some wine, you can't tell the bad wine anymore. Well, they'll feed you the bad wine. But he saved the best wine until last. And then it says in verse 11, This beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee, and manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him. So, as was mentioned, the book of John shows the miracles emphasize Christ's divine power. And this one emphasized God's power over quality. He created the finest wine that you could have. And he also, other things there are general lessons we can learn, and then each of the miracles has specific lessons that is a study in itself, that all of us can spend time just studying these miracles and looking into more detailed lessons that we can learn from them. But besides demonstrating God's power, in a sermon I heard on the UCG members site, when you can look at sermons, Mr. Lewis Bryant in 2010 had a sermon called The Miracles of Christ. And he said another miracle you can get from this is God can change the very nature of things. And if he can change the water into wine, he can change our human nature. So I thought that was a great thing to think about, very encouraging, that just like he changed water into wine, he can change my nature, our nature, to be like him. And also another thing is, it's interesting that God revealed this first to his servants. God sometimes often reveals things first to his servants before others become aware of these things. So these are some of the lessons just from that very first miracle. The next miracle is found in John 4, verses 46 through 54. That was the healing of a nobleman's son. And it says there in John 4, 46, it says, "And Jesus came again into Cana," back to that same small town of Galilee, where he had made the water wine. "And there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum." So Capernaum is about 16 to 18 miles east of Cana. And when he heard, when that nobleman heard that Jesus was come out of Judea into Galilee, he went unto him and besought him that he would come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. So he really felt it was very important for Christ to go to their home to heal his son. "Then said Jesus to him, except you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. The nobleman said to him, sir, come down ere my child die. Jesus said to him, go your way, your son lives." So here was an instance where a miracle was performed to show that Christ had power over distance, over space. He didn't have to physically go there. And so many times people have asked for anointed cloths, and before the anointed cloth reaches the people, they're healed just after they ask for the anointed cloth. They're not limited by distance and space. God is not limited by distance and space. So going down, it says, continuing, "Go, as I said, go your way, your son lives. And the man believed the word that Jesus had spoken to him, and he went his way. And as he was now going down, his servants met him and told him, saying, your son lives. Then inquired he of them the hour when he began to amend, and they said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour the fever left him. And the father knew that it was at the same hour in which Jesus said to him, your son lives, and himself believed in his whole house." Now, Christ said that he had had faith. He evidently had enough faith not to rush home, but he stayed overnight there before going the next day. And then he confirmed, yes, it was exactly the instant that Christ said, the same hour that his son was healed. The next day he found that out. Then the next one is the healing a lame or crippled man at the pool of Bethesda. And Bethesda means house of mercy or house of grace. Now, this is found in John 5, verses 1 through 9. And this has been found and is known, the site of Bethesda, which the two pools that are there in Jerusalem, a northern and southern pool, make up the pool of Bethesda. And it says, after this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is at Jerusalem by the sheep market a pool which is called in the Hebrew tongue Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of impotent folk, of blind, halt, and withered, waiting for the moving of the water. And I'm going to drop down to verse 5. And a certain man was there which had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lie and knew that he had been now a long time in that case, he saith to him, wilt thou be made whole? Do you want to be made whole? The impotent man answered him, sir, I have no man when the water is troubled to put me in the pool, into the pool. But while I am coming, another steps down before me. Jesus saith to him, rise, take up your bed and walk. And immediately the man was made whole and took up his bed and walked. And on the same day was the Sabbath. 38 long years he had been crippled like that. And this demonstrated, like I said in the book of John, this demonstrated Christ's power over time. It doesn't matter. Somebody could be afflicted for a long time, and that doesn't limit God that he might later answer that prayer. So he endured a long time, and then at the right time, according to God's supreme wisdom, and to be recorded for all eternity in the New Testament, and to be an example for us to read, Christ performed that healing. Now the next one is also in John. So these first ones were in the book of John. I apologize. This actually is in the book of Luke, chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. So we're jumping away from John. And this is the first miraculous catch of fish. So if we go to Luke, chapter 5, and verse 1, it says, and it came to pass that as the people pressed upon him to hear the word of God, he stood by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two ships standing by the lake, but the fishermen were gone out of them and were washing their nets. And he entered into one of the ships, which was Simon's, and prayed or asked him that he would thrust it out a little bit from the land. And he spoke. And then he said, then after this, after he spoke, he says, now when he had left speaking, he said to Simon, launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a draught. And Simon answering said to him, Master, we have toiled all night and have taken nothing. Nevertheless, at your word, I will let down the net. So think of it. They had been all night fishing and didn't catch a single fish. And when they had this done, they enclosed a great multitude of fishes. After Peter listened to Christ and put down his net on the side he told him to put it on, enclosed a great multitude of fishes into that net, and their net break, or actually the New King James says was breaking. It was about at the point of almost breaking. So one wonders, did God the Father give Christ the ability to see through down to the bottom of the lake to know exactly where those fish were? Because he dogmatically said, put your net over on this side and you'll get a whole bunch of fish. And then in preparation for this miracle, obviously, God made sure that no fish would be caught in the net during that night. There's all kinds of things. The more you think about these miracles, the more things you can think of behind the story, behind the scenes. Now the next miracle, delivering a synagogue demoniac. That's in, it's in both Mark 1 and 23 through 28 and Luke 4, 31 through 36. So I'll read from Luke. And if you read in Luke chapter 4, verses starting with verse 33. And in the synagogue there was a man, of course this was on the Sabbath, there was a man which had a spirit of an unclean, well, King James says devil or demon, and cried out with a loud voice. And next verse, saying, "Let us alone. What have we to do with you, you Jesus of Nazareth? Are you come to destroy us?" And, you know, as Mr. Jane said about blasphemy, some of this was blasphemous. The demons were really, they were saying the truth that he was Christ, but it was said in a blasphemous tone, undoubtedly. "I know you, who you are, the Son, the Holy One of God." So it was not in the right spirit that that man was uttering that. "And Jesus rebuked him, saying, 'Hold your peace and come out of him.' And when the demon, the devil, had thrown him in the midst, he came out of him and didn't hurt him." And in verse 36, "And they were all amazed and spoke among themselves, saying, 'What a word is this? For with authority and power he commands the unclean spirits, and they come out.'" They were amazed. The next one, healing Peter's mother-in-law. This is found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I'll go to, if we can stay in Luke, verses 38 through 39, just moving right along in, right where we are. "And he," in other words Christ, "arose out of the synagogue, and he entered into Simon's house. And Simon's wife's mother was taken with a great fever." So it wasn't just a minor fever. It was a great fever. "And they besought him for her." And then it says in verse 39, "And he stood over her and rebuked the fever, and it left her. And immediately she arose and ministered to him." And it says in Mark, the companion account in Mark 29-31, it says, "And he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and immediately the fever left her." So she had this great fever, and Christ came while she had the fever, with his hand he lifted her up, and as he was lifting her up, the fever instantly disappeared from her. Now the next one is the cleansing of a leper. And this, if we can go to Matthew in this case, it's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but if we can go to Matthew 8, Matthew chapter 8, verses 2 through 4. So, yes, thanks. Thanks for keeping the slides in sync. Matthew chapter 8, verses, starting with verse 2, says, "And behold, there came a leper and worshipped him, saying, 'Lord, if you will, you can make me clean.' And Jesus put forth his hand and touched him, saying, 'I will, be you clean.' And immediately his leprosy was cleansed." That was a no-no, to touch a leper. Mr. Edersheim wrote in his book about the life and times of Jesus the Messiah, "No less distance than 4 cubits, about 6 feet, must be kept from a leper. Or if the wind came from that direction and was blowing towards you, you need to be about 100 cubits was scarcely sufficient." In other words, it was a strict rule never to touch a leper. And Christ did that. So it said, going back to that, where I was, "And Jesus put forth his hand and touched him, saying, 'I will, be you clean.' And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus saith to him, 'See, thou tell no man, but go thy way, show thyself to the priest, and offer the gift that Moses commanded for a testimony unto them.'" Being that Christ was God, he had the love, and he had God's love and compassion within him. He knew he had a plan, and there was a certain schedule of events and timing for his 3.5 year ministry, and exactly when he should be crucified. But it was a great struggle within him, because of his compassion, it was hard to resist healing people because he had such compassion for them. So he asked them, please don't tell anybody about this. He didn't want things to get escalated. He didn't want the time of his passion and crucifixion to occur too soon. He had a time schedule. So he tried to tell people, please don't tell anybody about this. But of course, most of the time they couldn't contain themselves. And he had to go away sometimes so that things wouldn't get heated up too soon in his plan. So then the next one, if we can go to, is in Matthew 9, 2 through 8, Mark 2, and if we can actually go back to Luke 5 again, this is the healing of a paralytic, a paralyzed man. And this is a spectacular miracle. Luke chapter 5, verses 18 through 26, it says, starting with verse 18 of Luke 5, "And behold, men brought in a bed a man which was taken with a palsy, and they sought means to bring him in and to lay him before him. And when they could not find by what way they might bring him in because of the multitude, so that it was packed, the house was packed. This man was outside and they had him on a bed. They went upon the housetop and led him down through the tiling with his couch into the midst before Jesus." And that must have been quite a scene, to see them dismantling some of the tiles on the top of the roof, which means that they certainly had faith that Christ was going to heal him. And when he saw their faith, he said unto him, "Man, your sins are forgiven you." And the scribes of the Pharisees began to reason, saying, "Who is this which speaks blasphemies?" So they were accusing Christ of blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone? And when Jesus perceived their thoughts, he answered and said to them, "What do you reason in your hearts? What is easier, to say, 'Your sins be forgiven you,' or to say, 'Rise up and walk'? But that you may know that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins." He said to the sick of the palsy, "I say to you, arise, take up your couch, and go into your house." And immediately he rose up before them and took up that whereon he lay and departed to his own house, glorifying God. So there's another miracle. Not only did he enable him to now use his legs, but when you haven't used a muscle for a long time, there's atrophy. And you know how hard it is to use, if you've ever broken a bone or something and not used a muscle, and then right afterwards you've got to get used to using that muscle again. But he immediately was able to walk as if nothing had ever happened. Now the next miracle, healing a man with a withered hand. And if we can go to just to Luke 6, 6 through 11, and just stay in there. It's recorded in Matthew, Mark, as well as Luke. But let's just go here to Luke chapter 6, verses 6 through 11. "And it came to pass also on another Sabbath that he entered into the synagogue and taught, and there was a man whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and Pharisees watched him, whether he would heal on the Sabbath day, that they might find an accusation against him." And then in verse 8, and like I mentioned, one of the miracles shown is the miracle of being able to actually read the thoughts of the people. "And he knew their thoughts and said to the man which had the withered hand, 'Rise up and stand forth in the midst.' And he arose and stood forth. Then said Jesus to them, 'I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath days to do good or evil?'" So he was teaching another lesson there. And he asked them that question, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it. And looking around about them all, he said to the man, so evidently they didn't really answer him. They were silent. Looking around about them all, he said to the man, "Stretch forth your hand." And he did so. And his hand was restored whole as the other. It was just like it was new, his hand. And they were filled with madness and communed one another what they might do to Jesus. So instead of rejoicing at this wonderful miracle Christ did, they were angry at Christ. Now, the next miracle, the healing of the centurion's servant, is in Matthew and Luke. But if we can go to Matthew, in this case, chapter 8, verse 5. Matthew chapter 8, verse 5. It says, "And when Jesus was entered into Capernaum, there came to him a centurion beseeching him and saying, 'Lord, my servant lies at home sick of the palsy, grievously tormented.' And Jesus says to him, I will come and heal him.'" In this case, the man didn't ask him to come to his house. He asked him to heal his servant. And in this case, Christ said, "I'm going to come to your house." And the centurion answered and said, "Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but speak the word only, and my servant shall be healed. For I am a man under authority, and I give orders, and when I'm given orders, I obey them, and when I give orders, people obey me. So all you have to do is command that my servant be healed, and it will happen." And Christ marveled at his faith. And so, getting back into the story, when Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to them that followed, "Verily I say to you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. And I say to you that many shall come from the east and west and shall sit down," and he goes on to another thing, "shall sit down with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven." And then he goes on and he says some of the people of Israel will be taken to task for not having the faith they should have had. And this Gentile centurion had such faith that he displayed to Christ. So going to the next one is raising a widow's son. And this is only found in Luke chapter 7, verses 11 through 17. So Luke chapter 7, verses 11 through 17. It says, "And it came to pass the day after that he went into a city called Nain." That's another small town in Galilee, right near Capernaum and Cana. "And many of his disciples went with him, and much people. Now when he came nigh to the gate of the city, behold, there was a dead man carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And much people of the city was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her, and said to her, 'Don't weep.' And he came and touched the bier," and this is Luke chapter 7, verses 11 through 17. "And he came and touched the bier, and they that bare him stood still. And he said, 'Young man, I say to you, arise.' And he that was dead sat up and began to speak, and he delivered him to his mother." And you could imagine, and there came a fear on all, and they glorified God, saying that a great prophet is risen up among us, and that God had visited his people. So these, one of the main purposes of these miracles was to show Christ's divinity. And the next one is the healing of a blind and dumb demoniac. This was in Matthew 12:12 and Luke 11, verse 14. I'll just stay right there in Luke where we are. Luke 11, I should say, going to chapter 11, verse 14. We'll stay in the book of Luke. And it says right there, "And he was casting out a demon, and it was dumb. And it came to pass when the demon was gone out of the dumb, the dumb spake, and the people wondered." Actually, in Matthew 12:22, it says, "Then was brought to him one possessed with a demon, blind and dumb." So he was both blind and unable to speak. "And he healed him, insomuch that the blind and dumb both spake and saw." And now the next one, the stilling of a storm. If we can stay in Luke, go to Luke chapter 8, verses 20 through 25. So chapter 8, verses 20, starting with verse 22. Now it came to pass on a certain day that he went into a ship with his disciples, and he saith unto them, Let us go over to the other side of the lake. And they launched forth. But as they sailed, he fell asleep, and there came down a storm of wind on the lake, and they were filled with water. I usually don't drink water, but maybe I think I do need a cup, glass of water. Is there one here? Oh, right here. Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you. So he was on the boat and he fell asleep. And that was in verse 22. But as they sailed, he fell asleep, and there came down a storm of wind on the lake, and they were filled with water and were in jeopardy. And they came to him and awoke him, saying, Master, Master, we perish. Then he arose and rebuked the wind and the raging of the water, and they ceased. The wind and the water ceased raging, and there was calm. And he saith unto them, Where is your faith? And they were afraid, and they, being afraid, wondered, saying one to another, What manner of man is this, that he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him? An interesting thing I read is that every instance where it is recorded Christ's weakness and humanity is followed by a spectacular miracle. It's like we'll read about in the raising of Lazarus. It said Jesus wept. Right after that, there was a raising from the dead. We'll get to that one real shortly, but that's an interesting observation. So the next one is delivering the Gadarene demoniacs. We can go to Matthew 8, because that's the one. It's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but Matthew 8 is the one that mentions that there were actually two demon-possessed individuals there. So if we go to Matthew chapter 8 and 28 through 34. Matthew 8, starting in verse 28. And when he was come to the other side into the country of the Gergesenes, there met him two possessed with demons coming out of the tombs, exceeding fierce, so that no man might pass by that way. And behold, they cried out, saying, What have we to do with you, Jesus, you Son of God? Are you come here to torment us before the time? Now, this was a two-for-one miracle. Because not only did he cast out the demons, he killed a lot of swine, which were being raised probably for the Romans for food. So in verse 30, And there was a good way off from them a herd of many swine feeding. So the demons besought him, saying, If you cast us out, allow us to, or suffer us to go away into the herds of swine. And he said to them, Go, and when they were come out, and they went into the herd of swine, and behold, the whole herd of swine ran violently down a steep place into the sea and perished in the waters. And, of course, news of that spread. So the archaeologists believe they have a very strong case of where that is on the Sea of Galilee, where that could have happened. The next miracle, healing a woman with an issue of blood. And this is one miracle that's recorded in all four of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So if we can go to Luke chapter 8. So back to Luke chapter 8 and starting in verse 43. It says, And a woman having an issue of blood 12 years, which had spent all her living upon physicians, neither could be healed of any, came behind him and touched the border of his garment, and immediately her issue of blood stanched or dried up. And Jesus said, Who touched me? Now he was being mobbed by people who were touching him. When all denied, Peter and they that were with him said, Master, the multitude throng you and press you, and you're saying, Who touched me? And Jesus said, somebody hath touched me, for I perceive that virtue is gone out of me. In this case, it was not tsunami, it was dunamis. Maybe some of you remember this in Squaw Valley, but I will never forget this. An evangelist was speaking at Blythe Arena, and he was talking about this very verse. And you know, Blythe Arena had this canvas on the backside of the arena. At the time I was there, there was a canvas. And every time that the speaker mentioned something about Christ's power and dunamis, just at the right time, a wind whipped the canvas. It was just synchronized with his sermon. And many of us observed that. I'll never forget that. Seeing Christ was showing his power in controlling the wind right there during the sermon. But that was... and I don't think I actually read this to you yet. So, Luke 8:43. Yes, I did. I just read this to you. So, and Christ said, I did read this to you. And for I perceive that virtue is gone out of me. In other words, power. He felt that power leaving from him. And a lot of times, right after this, one of the first things Christ did, right after something like this, he went away from everybody and prayed. He had to get recharged because he still was a physical human being who had to go and draw close to God the Father. It wasn't an easy thing for Christ. He had to do his part to stay close to God. And when power left him like that, he had to go and get recharged. The next one, raising Jairus' daughter. This one, it's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but if we can go to Mark this time, chapter 5, verses 22 to 24 and 35 to 43. So just starting in Mark chapter 5, verse 22, it says, and behold, there cometh one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and when he saw him, he fell at his feet, at Christ's feet, and besought him greatly, saying, my little daughter lies at the point of death. I pray you, come, and lay your hands on her, that she may be healed, and she shall live. And Jesus went with him, and much people followed him and thronged him. Okay, now going down to verse 35, it says, while he yet spake, there came from the ruler of the synagogue, synagogue's house, certain, which said, thy daughter is dead. Why troublest thou the master any further? So he had asked for Christ to heal his daughter. Then another account went on, and then his servants came telling him that his daughter had died. And as soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, in verse 36, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, be not afraid, only believe. And he suffered no man to follow him, save Peter and James and John, the brother of James. And he comes to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and seeth the tumult, and them that wept and wailed greatly. And when he was come in, he saith to him, why make you this ado and weep? The damsel is not dead, but sleepeth. And they laughed him to scorn. But when he had put them all out, he taketh the father and the mother of the damsel, and them that were with him, Peter, James, and John, and entered in where the damsel was lying, and he took the damsel by the hand, and saith unto her, Talitha, so this is, we know what the word Talitha means here, Talitha kumi, which is being interpreted, damsel, I say to you, arise. And straightway, or immediately, the damsel arose and walked, and she was of the age of 12 years, and they were astonished with a great astonishment. You see, the miracles all happened in different ways, and there were different circumstances. They weren't cookie cutters of each other. The next one is healing of two blind men, And this is only in Matthew 9, verses 27 to 30. So Matthew chapter 9, verses 27 to 31. And when Jesus departed thence, two blind men followed him, crying and saying, "You son of David, have mercy on us." And when he was come into the house, the blind men came to him, and Jesus saith to him, "Believe you that I am able to do this?" They said to him, "Yes, Lord." Then touched he their eyes, saying, "According to your faith be it unto you." And their eyes were opened. And again Jesus charged them, saying, "See that no man know." But they just went ahead and broadcast it all around, and it was made famous throughout the area. The next one is right there. The next verses is verses 32 to 33, the delivering of a dumb demoniac. As they went out, behold, they brought to him a dumb man possessed with a demon. And when the demon was cast out, the dumb spake. And the multitudes marveled, saying, "It was never so seen in Israel." Now the next one. This one is in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And in John, and like I said, in the book of John, this demonstrated Christ's power over quantity, the physical laws of quantity. So back to John, we'll stay in Matthew, I'm sorry, Matthew 14, just to keep it easier to go to. Matthew 14, verses 14 through 21. And Jesus went forth and saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion toward them, and he healed their sick. And when it was evening, his disciples came to him, saying, "This is a desert place, and the time is now past. Send the multitude away that they may go into the villages and buy themselves victuals." And Jesus said to them, "They need not depart, give them to eat." And they said to him, "We have here but 5 loaves and 2 fishes. He said, "Bring them hither to me." And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the grass, and took the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and brake and gave the loaves to his disciples, and the disciples to the multitude. And they did all eat and were filled, and they took up the fragments and that remained 12 baskets full. And they that had eaten were about 5,000 men besides women and children. So way beyond who knows how many, but there was 5,000 just the men. Now the next one was walking on water. And this, if we can go to Matthew 14, back to Matthew 14, verse 24. It says, "But the ship was now in the midst of the sea, tossed." This was after the feeding of the 5,000 men, and so this was a short time after that. He had sent his disciples away, and it says, but he did not go with them initially. He stayed with the multitudes and sent them away while his disciples had left on a ship. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up into the mountain apart to pray. See, he had to get recharged. And when the evening was come, he was there alone. So he waited till the evening. But the ship was now in the midst of the sea, tossed with the waves, for the wind was contrary. By the way, it was a very short distance that was being traveled by that ship. But the wind and everything kept the ship from moving too far. It was still there. And in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went unto them walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a spirit." And they cried out for fear. And straightway Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." And of course Peter jumped out and said, "I want to come and be with you." And he walked there, and the obvious lesson from that is he started to take his mind away from Christ, and then he started to sink, and Christ had to rescue him. But then it says, "And immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him," Peter, "and said to him, O you of little faith, where did you doubt? And when they were come into the ship, the wind ceased." So another miracle was not only him walking on water, but then stopping the wind just at the right time. And then it says in John, it's chapter 6, it says, immediately the ship was at the land whither they went. So all of a sudden, that ship was at land right after that. So this definitely demonstrated the power over natural law, this miracle. The next one is the delivering of a Greek, or it was called the Syrophoenician daughter. Delivering the healing a daughter of a Greek lady. Now what happened, if we can go to Mark chapter 7, verses 24, it says, and from thence he arose and went into the borders of Tyre and Sidon and entered into a house and would have no man know it, but he could not be hid. Christ had been doing a lot of miracles. He had been very busy. He knew that he and his men needed some R&R. They needed to get recharged. So he went away to near the border with Tyre, and it says he would have no man know. He went trying to be not noticed, where he could just recharge, but he couldn't be. It couldn't. The news traveled, and this Gentile, it says, for a certain woman whose young daughter had an unclean spirit heard him and came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek, a Syrophoenician by nation, and she besought him that he would cast forth the devil out of her daughter. But Jesus said to her, and he had to know this lady to say what he said, and this was a remarkable lady. But Jesus said to her, let the children first be filled, for it is not fit or meet to take the children's bread and to cast it to dogs. And she answered and said to him, yes, Lord, yet dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. This was a remarkable lady, her attitude. And he said to her, for this saying, go your way. The devil is gone out of your daughter. And when she was come to her house, she found the demon gone out of her daughter. So she was a remarkable example. And the next one, the healing of a deaf mute in Decapolis. That's only in Mark chapter 31, chapter 7. Verses 31 through 37. And again, departing from the coasts of Tyre and Sidon, he came to the Sea of Galilee. And it says, they bring unto him one that was deaf and had an impediment in his speech. And straightway his ears were opened, and the string of his tongue was loosed, and he spake plain. Now we're getting near the end. So thanks. I'll go a few more here. Feeding of 4,000 plus women and children, that's in Matthew and Mark. But if we can just go to Matthew 15, verses 32 to 33, it says that Jesus called a disciple to him and said, this is verse 32, I have compassion on the multitude because they continue with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And I will not send them away fasting, lest they faint in the way. And then they said, we don't have enough money to buy the food. And there were. Jesus said to them, how many loaves have we? And they said to him, 7 and a few fishes. And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves and the fishes and gave thanks and brake them and gave to his disciples and the disciples of the multitude. And they did all eat and were filled, and they took up the broken meat that was left, 7 baskets full. And they that did eat were 4,000 men besides women and children. We're coming near the end here of these examples. The next one, healing a blind man at Bethesda. This was in Jerusalem, and this is in Mark 8, verses 22 through 26. And he comes, no, I'm sorry, I said wrong. This was Bethsaida, the city of Bethsaida, which was up north. This was not Jerusalem, not the pool of Bethesda, but up north in the city of Bethsaida. And he comes to Bethsaida, and they bring a blind man to him, and he besought him to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the town. And when he had spit on his eyes, he put his hands upon him, and he asked him if he saw aught. And he looked up and said, I see men as trees walking. After that, he put his hands upon his eyes and made him look up, and he was restored and saw every man clearly. So at first, he saw a blur, and then he saw clearly. Sometimes God does not perform miracles immediately, but through time, the miracle occurs. In this case, that's what happened. It was a gradual, more gradual of a miracle. Another one, delivering a demon-possessed boy. In this one, I'll just go right to Mark 9, verses 14 to 22. Christ rebuked the foul spirit, saying to him, "You dumb and deaf spirit, I charge you, come out of him, and enter no more into him." And the spirit cried and rent him sore and came out of him. So he said, don't ever come back to him. And it says in Luke, and Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the child and delivered him again to his father. And then the next, near the end here, the finding the tribute money. Peter was asked by some of the religious leaders, does your master pay tribute in the temple? Of course, he didn't know, but he blurted out, no, of course he does. I mean, yes, of course he does. He pays the tribute tax in the temple. So when he got back, Christ knew what he had told them. So he said, and this is found in Matthew, only in Matthew 17, verses 24 through 27. Jesus said to him, what do you think, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute? Of their own children or of strangers? So in other words, have you ever heard a king who taxes his children? And Peter says, no. He says, well, then are the children free. In other words, I don't have to pay tribute at the temple. But notwithstanding, lest we should offend them, go thou to the sea and cast an hook and take up the fish that first comes up, and when you have opened his mouth, you shall find a piece of money. That take and give to them for me and you in the temple. So the question I have is, was the coin down there and the fish swallow it? Did God create the coin right inside the fish's belly? There's a lot of details, things that we just don't know, all the intricacies, how God planned to do that miracle. But he was prepared. He was prepared to teach Peter a lesson, and it definitely shows that God does have a sense of humor. And then another one, healing a man born blind. And of course, this is in John chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. That was at the Pool of Siloam, and that site was discovered by archaeologists in 2005 in Jerusalem, the Pool of Siloam. And demonstrates God's power over misfortune. So if we can just go quickly to John chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth. When he had thus spoke, and then later on it says, he encountered that man, and he spoke, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man. This man had been born blind with the clay, and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is by interpretation sent. And he went his way there, therefore, and washed and came seeing. So this man had been born blind and lived all those years so that Christ would perform this miracle and it would be recorded in the New Testament for all of us forever. God has a view of life way beyond our limited view of years and time. So this was powerful. So brethren, I'll just say these very quickly. Healing of a crippled woman on the Sabbath. That was in Luke 13, verse 10 through 17. You can read that. Healing a man with dropsy, which is swelling in his body, swelling of the tissues. That's in Luke 14, verses 1 through 6. There was a certain man before him which had the dropsy. And Jesus answered and spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And when they held their peace, and he took him and healed him. And then the one, the raising of Lazarus, is the next one in John 11. So when at my mom's funeral, I didn't say anything at the church and let the minister, the priest at the church speak at the funeral, but I asked that I could speak at the graveside, which I did in front of all of my relatives and told them about the resurrection. And I read them John 11, the raising of Lazarus. And then I mentioned all kinds of my relatives who had died that they grieved for, and that each of them, I told them that specifically that they would see them again. So I used this powerful miracle. And so we are undoubtedly very familiar with this. It demonstrates God's power over death. And after 4 days in the grave, if you read it in John 11, verses 17 through 44, he commanded that they open the tomb, and when he had thus spoken, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. So he was spectacularly raised from the dead. Then there were in Luke 17, 11 through 17, 10 lepers were cleansed. Only one came back to thank him, a Samaritan. But that's found in Luke 17, 11 through 19. Then there's the healing of the two blind men in Jericho. This was done on the last journey of Christ, on his way from the north, from Galilee and all, through Jericho to Jerusalem, in preparation for his last Passover and the crucifixion. And on his way, there was a blind man. His name was Bartimaeus. There were two men. There were two blind men. One of them was named Bartimaeus. But if you read in Matthew 20, it specifically says, in verses 29 through 34, it says, "And as they departed from Jericho, a great multitude followed him, and behold, two blind men sitting by the wayside. When they heard that Jesus passed by, cried out, saying, 'Have mercy on us, O Lord.'" And then later on it says, "And they say to him, 'Lord,'" he said, "What do you want me to do?" He said, "Lord, that our eyes may be opened." So Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes, and immediately their eyes received sight. Then came the cursing of the fig tree in Matthew 21. When he was journeying with his disciples from Bethany down to Jerusalem, and he pronounced a curse on a fig tree, and then the next day that fig tree had withered. That's in Matthew 21 and in Mark 11. And there were a lot of lessons that he was leaving, the final lessons he was giving his disciples. Then comes the second to last is the restoring of Malchus's ear after Peter had a sword and missed probably dispatching of the servant of the servant of the high priest Malchus, but he did cut off his ear, and Christ put it right back on. And then after the resurrection was the second miraculous catching of fish, which he did when the disciples again couldn't catch fish, and he told them to go somewhere and fish, and they caught all kinds of fish. So, brethren, I went through all of those. I think we can establish the point that Christ did many miracles. And these were only the ones that were specific, besides all those others. And there were probably many other miracles that Christ did that were unique and totally different than these miracles that he did. But Christ did not see the need for those to be written down. Just two more points before the conclusion, two more comments to make. You hear a lot about in apocryphal books and legends that before Christ's 3.5 years, Christ did, as a child, perform many miracles. And they're non-biblically based. and they're not credible. And it seems to indicate in John chapter 2, in the first miracle of Canaan, that that was the first miracle Christ did. So there's no real credibility that Christ performed. And a lot of these legends are only, they're really magical tricks, mostly, that the legends are, that that are recorded in legends in apocryphal books. Now, the other thing I just wanted to mention before conclusion is that how could, as Mr. James talked about that, and this is something to really think about, how could those religious leaders, with all those miracles, deny that Jesus was the true Messiah? Of course, they had closed their minds, they had a hard hearts, and as Mr. James said, some of them were in danger of blaspheming against the Holy Spirit because some of them knew better, evidently knew better. But those people, because they did not accept Christ as being the Messiah, they were not expecting a Christ to come as a humble human being and be crucified. They expected a glorified Messiah to come and free them from Rome. So they applied Deuteronomy 13 to Christ, verses 1 through 3. The Jewish leaders said that if anyone comes, anyone performs miracles, but if they blaspheme or do any other, follow another god, and they perform miracles, don't follow them. They applied Deuteronomy 13 to Christ. The one who actually inspired Deuteronomy 13, that verse was turned around and used by the religious leaders in what they said to the masses in trying to convince them not to follow Christ. Quite interesting. So they deceived themselves into rejecting Christ and saying he was blaspheming by saying he was God, even though the miracles were so powerful as to undeniably give a stamp that he was the true Messiah. So brethren, in conclusion, thank you for enduring this. The recorded miracles of that Jesus Christ performed during his physical life, they are many, they were many, and they were spectacular. And they were befitting of somebody who really was the Messiah. You would expect nothing less, from somebody who was the true Messiah and who was divine and had all that power, that he would do those things. We are called, when God calls us, we know nothing about him. And we see through a glass darkly, and we continually learn about God. These miracles that were recorded give us another glimpse into God's power and his love and compassion. We're still seeing through a glass darkly, but by studying these miracles, we get to know God better. We get to know his power, and that, like it says in Luke 1:37, with God nothing shall be impossible. In other words, there is absolutely nothing impossible with God. That's the lesson, a lesson from these miracles, besides showing his love and compassion. So brethren, they also are a foretaste. They give us just a glimpse, a foretaste of the miracles God is yet, and Christ is yet to perform. When we think of when Christ returns and all of the healings of the broken people after the Great Tribulation, and all the healings he is going to do, and the Great White Throne Judgment, and the resurrection to physical life in the Great White Throne Judgment, to coin a phrase from Al Jolson, we ain't seen nothing yet. This is just a glimpse, a foretaste of the future miracles Jesus Christ is yet to perform for humanity. But they do confirm that human being who came here 2,000 years ago, Jesus of Nazareth, was truly the Messiah.